This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Former President Trump is facing new charges, including allegations of obstruction of justice and the willful retention of national defense information. This brings the total number of charges to 40 in the first ever federal indictment of a former president. This comes as a third defendant has been named in the case. CBS's Robert Costa.
A third person named as a defendant in that Mar-a-Lago's document case, Carlos de Oliveira, a worker at the property, was accused of attempting to delete security footage. Trump was also charged with new counts, including an additional count of retaining more classified documents. CBS News has identified that document as related to Iran and national security, and which Trump has allegedly have shown that to aides.
After Trump's lawyers met today with prosecutors in special counsel Jack Smith's office, a federal grand jury reconvened in the January 6th investigation, in which the former president has been told he's a target. CBS's Scott McFarlane with GOP reaction to the former president's legal troubles.
Republicans have continued this argument that they believe the Biden administration, the Justice Department, are weaponizing federal prosecutions and the Justice Department itself to target Donald Trump ahead of 2024.
A new study shows that people who had just under 4 minutes of vigorous movement daily, like walking uphill, reduced their cancer risk by almost 20%. CBS News medical contributor Dr. Celine Gounder.
Unfortunately, most middle-aged adults in the United States don't exercise, and they're at increased risk for certain cancers. Exercise isn't just about weight loss or cardiovascular fitness, and no diet pill has been shown to reduce the risk of cancer in this way.
The United Nations says July is on track to become the hottest month ever on record. CBS's Ian Lee has more on some of the impacts.
In Algeria, raging infernos are burning through mountain villages, killing dozens. In Syria, firefighters are struggling to beat back blazes. Officials around the Mediterranean blame this summer's wildfires for killing more than 40 people, while leaving thousands more homeless.
Casino mogul Steve Wynn has ended his long legal fight with Nevada gambling regulators over claims of workplace sexual misconduct by paying a $10 million fine. Randy Meisner, a founding member of the Eagles who added high harmonies to such favorites as Take It Easy and The Best of My Love, and sang and co-wrote the hit Take It to the Limit, has died at age 77. The Eagles say in a statement that Meisner died yesterday from complications from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Now. Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. You could see some severe weather this afternoon and evening, as the National Weather Service in the Twin Cities says there's an enhanced risk of severe weather north of a line from about Polk County through Chippewa County and Wausau, and south of that line, a marginal risk. That means that severe storms are possible, could be scattered, with the main threats being high and damaging winds and large hail, and also the potential for isolated tornadoes as part of tonight's storm system. It comes after hot and humid weather across most of Wisconsin, with temperatures well into the 90s and heat indices reaching triple digits in some areas. If you are out and about, this week is the 99th Eau Claire County Fair. The event is on Eau Claire's south side, is in its first full day today, and has animal exhibits and contests from baking to building Legos. Admission and parking to the fair is free. The Dunn County Fair's first full day is today as well. The fairgrounds east of Menominee. Admission to each day of the fair is $5. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to The Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Todd Alba Show.
I've been pretty rough on the Joint Finance Committee. I know you're going to give bipartisan praise that they're going to raise the pay for district attorneys and public defenders. You don't get an attaboy for finally saying, we finally heard people cry uncle enough times. You either govern all the time or not once a decade when it's suddenly convenient. So,
but I think we have to at least give people hope once in a while that there is something happening in Madison that is a little bit on the good side.
The Todd Alba Show, weekday afternoons 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Tom from Madtown. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys. Heard you talking about Robin Boss, so I called Robin Boss's office and said, yeah, why is DEI so dangerous? And nothing. The guy just stopped talking. I said, hello, are you there? I called him back, and the phone got picked up, and then they didn't say anything. You know, maybe you'll learn something if you listen to The Devil's Advocate.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Alba Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
News and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this Medicare Advantage thing has really taken off. I've gotten several emails already from folks going, beware, stay away, not good. And look, you know, we see all these advertisements on TV. There's tons of them. Tons of ads about how wonderful it is, how you get all of these benefits, all this stuff, all these sweeteners. And, you know, it's like they say, devil's in the details. And before we move on, I want to go to Bob in San Jose. He's got a story for us. Bob, thanks for calling in.
Yes. Actually, I should mention, my wife was an employee of a local government agency for 20-plus years, and we had an HMO medical plan through the contract with their employer. I was a dependent on that. When she retired, it continued that same medical plan, in effect, for retirees, which became a Medicare Advantage plan, if you will. And now she had large, lumpy breasts, and her original doctor years ago said, you need a mammogram and an ultrasound. And the ultrasound was because of the lumps. You could tell what they were. Because her comment to me, she's like a half a dozen lumps in each breast. I can't tell if one of them's getting a little bigger than it was before. Anyway, so for 10 years, she had an ultrasound and a mammogram. On year number 11, and I'll be snarky about this and say somebody in a high-rise, a 35th floor of a high-rise building somewhere looking at a computer screen made this decision. They did not do the ultrasound. They did do the mammogram, and it was clear. Year number 12, there was something very faint in the mammogram. They did the ultrasound. The machine looks, the handheld part of it, it looks sort of like a flashlight. Press it against her breast.
Right.
And she said, she could see it on the screen. She said, Bob, it's the size of a walnut. They scheduled her for surgery, took it out. They took out it was cancer. They took out 6 lymph nodes in her armpit. 3 of them also were cancer. So it was already metastasizing. I looked this up later on. And it turns out there's about a dozen different kinds of breast cancer, not just one. And the ultrasound sees a difference in the density of the tissue. That's what makes it visible.
Right.
The mammogram sees the accumulation of calcium in the tissue. And not all of those not all of the cancer varieties, of which there's a dozen, accumulate calcium, which is why the kind of cancer she had didn't show up. And I believe that had, you know, when they took it out, they said stage 3+. 6 months later, they said stage 4. She said, how long do I have? 3 to 5 years. She made it to 5 years, was active all the way to the end. But that decision for year number 11 to not do the ultrasound, That is the part where I point a finger at a corporation saying, why? When you know the mammogram is only 90%, not 100%, for detecting breast cancer. Why did this have to happen?
Yeah, especially when you're talking about people older in years.
It was stockholder. You know, it was the stock price or shareholders or something that said we're wasting money doing a test that keeps coming up negative. I think that's what it really was.
No, I'm sorry, Bob.
I'm telling you this is I want other women to know that a mammogram is 90%, and they should ask for a ultrasound. Especially if they have lumps, because the ultrasound can discriminate between the lumps much better than they can with their hands.
All right. I appreciate the call, Bob. Thanks for the story. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You hear these tragic stories, you know, sadly too often, and this is why I'm a supporter of Medicare, of Medicare for all. That everyone, when you need care, you get the care that you need, and the stuff that your doctor says you need. None of these denials, just for the sake of denials. It's infuriating. And look, you know, at the end of this, we've got a lot of work to do on this issue. The economy has grown at a pretty good rate, 2.4% in the second quarter. It's not bad. We've seen some job production numbers here in my state of Pennsylvania, more than 28,000 manufacturing jobs. Means Biden care, Bidenomics, kind of working. And here to share some thoughts on those stories and much more, I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be in your show, Rick. Thank you.
So what do you make of the economic numbers? What do you make of the 2.4% rate of growth in the last quarter?
That means the total income of everybody on average is growing 2.4% more than inflation. And that's good. More people have jobs. Fewer people are unemployed. Those people who have jobs are spending money. And people are earning tips. And people are earning wages. And people are serving tables. And people are pouring beer. And lots of people are working and earning. And that is a cycle that's working in the correct direction. As more people make more money, more people make more money. And it's working out. And it's generally good for a lot of us. And so I think we should be happy.
No, we should be happy. But you know, I look at the numbers, and Biden's not getting the credit I think he deserves. I think a lot of this has to do with the policies that they've enacted. I mean, we're manufacturing jobs are coming back, as I pointed out. The last numbers I saw, Pennsylvania, more than 28,000 manufacturing jobs. Wisconsin, more than 20,000. Michigan, more than 22,000. Georgia, more than 32,000 manufacturing jobs. It looks like we're doing the work of bringing stuff back a little bit.
Yeah, people are buying cars. People are buying air conditioners. People are buying a lot of stuff.
Yeah, people are buying air conditioners because it's freaking hot.
You better believe it.
No, I mean, you know, did you see the story in Arizona where evidently the number of burns from people just falling has skyrocketed? Yeah. They're just walking down the street, trip and fall, and now they've got burns?
It's crazy. I live in New York City, and I mean, it's not quite that bad here. It was 93 today, you know, in front of my office outside.
It's a good thing you got an air conditioner.
Yeah, good thing we have air conditioning around here.
No, I mean, look, you know, disaster capitalism will bring us some opportunities, I guess. There'll be jobs in that. But, you know, the reality is, and this is where I think what has to be done a little bit better is touting the fact that the economy is moving in a better direction. Inflation's down, wages are going up, consumer confidence, you know, in a bunch of places is up. This has got to be something I think that the Biden administration's got to take credit for, because it's on his watch.
Yeah.
If it were going the other way, we'd be blaming him.
Yeah, more people have more jobs, and that's good. I mean, that's why some of these companies are ending up hiring children to do work now, because they can't find enough adults, or they're not paying enough for the adults to be willing to work, since there's plenty of other jobs available. And that's part of the problem, but that's what the government's for, is to root these things out and track them down and get children out of these jobs and into schools and adults to work.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, you're probably only a couple years older than me. I thought that child labor was one of those things we decided 100 years ago. I thought the Fair Labor Standards Act had pretty much wiped that all out. I thought, you know, in the 30s we did away with this stuff, and yet here it's rearing its ugly head back. And you've got states like Iowa that I thought were at one point sane, you know, completely going in and gutting things. I mean, we've had a couple of kids die on the job here recently, where you thought, you know, those are stories from the past.
And there's a bunch of states, typically Republican states, that want to change the laws so that children will be allowed to work in more things, more times. You know, my kids went to school at Ethel Kultur, where they have the original photos that Lewis Hines made that turned the tide in terms of child labor not being allowed. And, you know, those picture the little kids working in coal mines and canneries. And I mean, just disgusting.
Yeah. No, I mean, when we did our Working Class Hero radio tour, we ended up in Scranton and we had some free time. So we went and did the coal mine tour, where they take you down a couple hundred feet down into the earth, and they show you what it was like to be a coal miner 100 years ago. And they have this little doll, just a little kid, you know, 5-6 years old. And that person's job was to open and close the fire damp door. And the guy said that kid had a 50% fatality rate. And you stop and think about that for a second. 50% of the kids that families sent down into those mines did not make it out. And it was, you know, the job of the foreman to, when they got killed, throw their lifeless bodies up on the coal cart, drag them to the surface, clip-clop them back to the house, and literally throw the bones against the door to let the family know that their loved one was home. And that was kind of your eviction notice as well. Because, you know, now you don't have a breadwinner. You got no way to pay the rent. Time to go. That's the world that we came from. And I thought we had decided, no, we don't want that anymore. But it looks like we're inching. Well,
that was great for some people. And some folks want to go back to the way it was. You know, back when America was great for some of us and pretty deadly for others of us.
Now, this idea of child labor, I mean, you know, I've been saying for a long time, I go back to my grandparents' generation. They were able to make an existence on one income. My grandfather was a truck driver. My grandmother stayed home, raised her children. When they got older, she went off and got another job for a little pin money, a little something for the side. You know, my parents' age generation needed two incomes. You know, I was a latchkey kid. Now we're sadly in a point, Morris, and you know, while the economy is looking okay and going in the right direction, I'm arguing we're a three income for most working families situation, and now you've got Republican states going, yeah, get those kids back into the workforce, make them more productive.
Well, you know, the old saying that you know, the government wants to come give people more jobs, and the answer is, well, I don't need another job, I already have three. We need jobs that pay enough money so the person can support their family. That's what we had when America was great. People getting good union jobs, people making wages where they support a spouse and kids and make the mortgage payments and go to Disney World for a week every other year. You know, that's when America, when more of our income was going to labor and less to capital. And that's been going the wrong way. Well, it's been going in favor of capital little by little every year for the last 90. Capital's been getting a bigger share of income. Labor's getting a lower share of income.
And it's only going to get worse.
That's what you need to change.
But it's only going to get worse. You know, yesterday we had on the program an expert talking about AI. And as AI comes more and more online, I fear that pendulum keeps swinging toward the side of capital as productivity gains are going to be in the hands of fewer and fewer people as working people end up losing their jobs.
Yes. I know. I mean, some people have jobs they do with their brains and some people have jobs they do with their hands. But I think both of those are at risk now. And that's why the writers are on strike. Who write comedy because they're afraid of being replaced by AI. You know, actors are on strike. You know, Disney said that their secret of success was the fact that Mickey Mouse does not go on strike. They can just hire different artists to draw him if the artists don't want to. But that's where the world is coming to. And we've been there before.
Sure.
People have been afraid of lots of other things. You know, back when they first automated, you know, the looms for the producing cotton, people were afraid that would be the end of jobs. Back when steam engines first came into use, people were afraid that would be the end of manual labor. And it hasn't. People have been doing different things, and it's been hugely disruptive to generations of people.
Yeah, I mean, those folks did suffer. And I keep saying that this transition, this technological advancement, if you will, we need smarter policies to ensure that working people don't take it on the chin again this time, as they have through every other technological change.
Yeah, we need, well, same thing I said before, we need people with good union jobs that pay living wages. And that's what we had when America was great, and that's what we need again. And some of us want to go completely the opposite direction.
Yeah.
We're more concerned with the profits of the business owners than they care about, you know, the livelihoods of the workers.
Now here's the weird thing, though, Morris. I mean, you're a Wall Street guy. You don't hear many. I don't hear many Wall Street guys with that sort of opinion. It's all about, you know, we need quarterly profits. We need to get kids back to work so that we can use those little hands to get into little spots. I'm struggling here.
I own stock in companies. In fact, I retired almost 10 years ago. All of my income is what I make from my stocks, you know, paying dividends and going up in value. So sure, I want companies to make profits, but I also want companies to make profits 20 years from now and 40 years from now, you know, when my 4-year-old granddaughter is going to college and getting a job. And I want the economy to still be there for her. I don't want this country to end up like Greece was when I was there in 2013, or South Africa was in the 1980s. You know, as I said before, these things did not end well for the rich people. And I'm afraid, Rick, that the American people who work for a living are just going to get up and be fed up with this and not going to take it anymore pretty soon.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, Tucker Carlson, I didn't think Tucker Carlson and I would ever agree on anything, but he said that automated trucks shouldn't be allowed to exist because, you know, truck driving is the number one job for high school educated men in this country. And if you take that away, just what you've said, you've got a lot of people with nothing to do, and chaos will certainly ensue.
Well, we have to have provisions for that. We have to do something about that. And it's not just giving people money. That's not going to make people happy. It's just going to remind them that they can't earn a living to support their families. So we have to have a way in which people still have jobs and make money from those jobs. Like, you know, the senator from your next state to the West talks about respect for workers and respect for work. And we need that. Not just respect for wealth,
right?
Respect for work and labor and earning a living.
Now, you know, again, you know, I go back to, you know, Newt Gingrich, I think when he was running for president a number of years ago, saying, you know, we need to get these kids back to work, get them in the schools, fire the union janitor, and get them to work cleaning the bathrooms. There's that competing ideology that we got a lot of productive labor here. We can get them cheap. But, you know, they're not kids that look like yours or mine, though. They tend to be, you know, kids of, you know, the immigrant persuasion.
Yeah, it's just the idea that people think of people that have a different color skin or worship their God a different way or have funny names are like less than human. It's like, it's a scary thought. Like, think of what's happening in the Rio Grande in Texas and,
yeah,
you know, what's happening in Jerusalem too, for that matter, but.
No, it's crazy times we're in now. For me, I keep coming back to the tax code, and every time we talk, it comes back to this. And now you guys just had a major success in the fact that the Oligarch Act has been introduced, that we're going to possibly start going after the extreme of extreme wealth. We had a guy on last night, Bob Lord, who walked us through what that was. This is a pretty big deal, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. I mean, we don't expect it to, you know, be completely done this year. I'm not exactly, you know, talking about whether we should have the signing ceremony in the East Room or the South Lawn yet. But, you know, we have 10 or 20 sponsors now. We'll get some senators. And in the next Congress, if people who work for a living get out and vote, we'll have Congress people who will pass this in 2025 and get it signed by the president.
And real quick, I mean, you know, the fact that you're taxing wealth, I think the number was 2% from anywhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times the median wealth of the country, which you guys have pegged at 120,000, all the way up to 8% for people with 1 million times the median wealth, which you think about 1 million times the median wealth would be what, about $120 billion?
$120 billion.
Just unimaginable to me.
And even if they pay that 8% tax, they will still be wealthier at the end of the year than they were at the beginning. Because these people are earning more than 8% on their money.
Yeah.
So their wealth will still go up, but just not quite as fast.
Yeah, I've been watching that Mackenzie Scott. I don't know if you've been watching how much. She's just trying to give money away. And she's actually growing her wealth faster than she can literally give it away.
Yeah, when you are rich, you just get richer whether you like it or not, because you get a return on your in savings. And when you work for a living and living paycheck to paycheck, you generally get poorer as time goes on. And that's the problem with the way our society is set up. The rich are getting richer, and a lot of people are just struggling to get by every single week, and we have to change that.
So walk me through how we get, because you know, I've had conversations with people, Morris, you know, friends who are like, oh, we can't raise any more taxes. I'm taxed enough already. How do we get people to realize that we're not talking about them being taxed? Because I know, you know, the mastery of the right was, you know, death tax. I mean, really, you know, Frank Luntz and his linguistics, or just, you know, got, you know, working class people making $20,000-$30,000 a year worried that they're going to be taxed when they die because there's a death tax, was just incredible. But how do we get people beyond the idea that, look, we're talking about people with unimaginable wealth for most working people? You know, I know you guys are trying. How do we move that?
We have to get them to imagine the unimaginable. We have to explain to people what it really means to have $120 million saved up. You know, the kind of wealth, not that you are like a star of the, you know, football team, of the, you know, Philadelphia Eagles. You're the guy who owns the Philadelphia Eagles. You know what I mean? That level of wealth. We have to get people to understand how wealthy these couple of thousand most wealthy people in the country really are.
No, Shaquille O'Neal, you know, I think said it best. He said, I'm rich. The guy who signs my paycheck, he's wealthy.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And people, I don't even think they even have any idea of that. I answer questions sometimes. People ask me, well, how could Jeff Bezos get so rich? His salary's only whatever it is. And his salary could be zero and he'd be richer than any of us. Because he's rich because he owns the company, or a big part of it, not because of anything to do with his salary. And that's just so beyond the thinking of so many people.
Yeah.
Not because they're stupid. It's because it's so outside of their experiences. Their experiences, you get rich by having a salary that's a little bit higher than your expenses and saving a little bit. No. You get rich by owning something that becomes incredibly valuable over time. That's how you get rich.
Yeah.
And people have to understand that a little bit more. And that's what we're doing at the Patriotic Millionaires.
Yeah, I remember back in the 70s, you had Lee Iacocca, who only took a dollar. You know, everyone's like, oh my God, he's only working for a dollar. What they didn't know is he was working for stocks. So he was getting stock options, and he was that's where he was making his money. It wasn't the buck that he was paying actual wage tax on. It was that capital gains that he was getting on the other end that nobody ever really talked about.
Yeah, when I was working in the finance industry, I don't even know what my salary was, honestly. But it didn't make any difference almost, because a huge amount of our pay was like options and stock and the company we worked for, and we were ending up owning part of it. And it's a completely different idea of making money, of just sort of making your wealth grow, not being paid for the labor that you do.
Yeah.
People are going to understand.
No, this is a big deal, and I know we're going to talk about this again down the road. But as always, I appreciate you taking a little time, giving us some insight into your world, and maybe helping guide us in a better direction. But Morris, I appreciate the time.
Anytime, Rick. Thank you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Morris Pearl. He is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1903. Labor leader Mother Mary Harris Jones was leading a march of children laborers to President Theodore Roosevelt's summer home in New York. The long march had begun 20 days before in Philadelphia. Mother Jones was hoping to draw national attention to the plight of child workers. The action caught the public's attention, and across the nation, newspapers reported on the March of the Mill Children. All the way in Leadville, a town in the mountains of Colorado west of Denver, the Herald Democrat carried the story of Mother Jones's East Coast March. The paper's July 27th article began, quote, "It is a pathetic spectacle. That little army of Mother Jones marching through the broiling heat of summer lay a petition before the president. She says truly that her errand is as vital as any which takes persons to Oyster Bay. She comes to please the cause of the child laborers, and to emphasize her protest, has with her several score of ill-clad, puny children, the result of the enforced work of these children in factories. When the children's march reached the president's door 2 days later, the president was not there to meet them. Yet the march had sparked national attention. In 1904, the National Child Labor Committee formed to take action on the issue. Pennsylvania passed tougher child labor restrictions the next year, but federal protections would have to wait until the next President Roosevelt. The passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, signed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, finally included nationwide limits to child labor. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
As John Mellencamp sings, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. True. And it's equally true that if you stand for everything, you won't amount to anything. In a remarkable achievement, a newly formed political party calling itself No Labels has managed to fall into both traps, standing up for everything and nothing at all. The fledgling entity is using every synonym in the book to assure everyone that it is a middle-of-the-road bipartisan centrist, both sides party, offering hybrid liberal-conservative solutions that won't offend anyone. But wait, they've chosen a multimillionaire coal baron and a multimillionaire son of a global plastics polluter to be their standard bearers. As a presidential ticket, Democrat Joe Manchin and Republican John Huntsman probably would unite voters of both parties against them. While they don't stand for much, there is one huge overriding issue that the No Labels hucksters strongly agree on: corporate money contaminating American politics. These, quote, reformers are in favor of it. Indeed, secret fat cat donations are the No Labelers' financial lifeline, having already hauled in hundreds of thousands of dollars from right-wing corporate interests. Such as, no, no, say the founders, we can't tell you who's buying the No Labels label, for the funders don't want the public to know their names or their special interests. Of course, secret funding of elections equals secret government of, by and far, the funders. By standing against the people's right to know, the group has put a flaming neon fraud label on their hokey reform party. Huntsman even admits it, saying financial disclosure would be the right thing to do, but, quote, that's not the way you play the game. This is Jim Hightower saying, the game? Just what we need, another gang of corporate politicos who think governing America is a game to be won by hook or crook. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news for the folks who work for the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA. Evidently, as is being reported, they've hit a major milestone this week in their efforts to be like full employees of the federal government. Evidently, the 60,000 employees of the agency are now going to begin receiving paychecks that are somewhere, you know, around everybody else. What's being reported is a 30% raise. That seems pretty substantial. And here to share some thoughts on if that's accurate and maybe fill us in on how things are at the TSA, I've asked Johnny Jones to come talk with us. He's the Secretary Treasurer of AFGE Council 100. You can check out their website, AFGEcouncil100.org. Johnny, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's always a welcome opportunity to share the good words about what's happening to our officers across the United States.
So I'm looking at this, and it's saying, this is what this report is. It's saying 60,000 employees are going to begin receiving paychecks reflecting up to a 30% raise. Is that true?
Yes, the information is correct. Unfortunately, some of those that are getting the pay increase right now, there's a proposal in Congress to kind of take some of the pay back from the non-frontline workers. We don't represent those guys, but as good workers of the TSA, you should never have a two-pay system in place. It would cause problems if I was making more money than my manager.
Yeah,
they might be upset with Johnny.
I can't imagine anyone being upset with you. But here's the thing: the question is how did this situation? How was this allowed to happen so long? I mean, the TSA was set up after 9/11. We're talking now, 22 years ago? How has it taken so long to get to this point?
Well, you got to remember, let's start from the beginning. In 2002, the agency was created after the September 11th attacks, and November of 2001, they passed ATSA, which created the TSA, and they had to put this agency together real quick. So they didn't really want to deal with some of the standard government stuff like Title V like rights. So the administrator was given broad authority to create his own pay system, his own disciplinary and systems. And they said, well, we'll fix it like this for temporary, and we'll come back and fix it later. Well, here we are 20 years later, finally getting fixed. But we didn't have collective bargaining rights. There's actually two-pronged problems, there's many parts, but most agencies have what they call Title V rights. And Title V will give you the GS pay system, it'll give you the Merit System Protection Board, and also give you full collective bargaining rights. Our officers did not have any collective bargaining rights until 2011. We did not get MSPB rights until 2021. And we did not receive our pay equity or similar pay until 2023, which actually your first paycheck came out this Thursday officially, which was today. It's a big, big accomplishment. But if you've been here for 20 years, you've been through a battle to get this done.
No, and as I've talked to my friends at AFGE, this has been one of those things they've been fighting from the beginning, because originally you guys weren't given rights to any collective bargaining, because as you pointed out, this was a slapdash, hurry up, get it done, and have complete and total dictatorial control by the overseers, because they didn't want any people, you know, opening their big mouths and exposing stuff. And this is why you do need to have collective bargaining rights, and why it's good on you guys for fighting for this. So this is kind of a celebration moment, right?
Oh, man, this is such a big celebration. Our friends in Congress, both sides of the aisle, have recognized the fact that the TSA workforce, the frontline workforce in particular, has been greatly abused by the agency, given the fact that we have, prior to this year, the agency's hiring 10,000 and losing 10,000. Just to give you an idea, you have 45,000 bargaining employees, frontline officers, and they're having to hire 10,000 a year. The attrition rate is horrible, but now under the pay equity and having full collective bargaining rights, we've seen a 50% drop in people leaving the agency. So we're obviously getting better to where we're at, but we still need to have Title V rights in statute. Right now we have what they call administrative Title V rights. The current administrator, Pekoske, under the direction of President Biden and Secretary Mayorkas, granted us provisional Title V-like rights under his new determination, which he was given that authority under ATSA. So what we're trying to do is to codify this stuff in the law and take those rights away, because no administrator in the government has the right to suspend bargaining, dictate what your pay is going to be. So that has been a tremendous failure. That's why we're here today, under this proposal.
So all I got out of that is this is pretty good. There's a lot of Title V, a lot of APSA, a lot of this, a lot of that. For those of us who don't speak government, this is a good thing, right?
Oh, this is a great thing. If you're an average TSO, I'll give you an idea. Let me share my own personal experience. I've been a TSO since 2002. My pay prior to the rollout, this new pay equity, was $52,000 a year. Under the pay equity program, I'm now making $68,000 a year. Oh. So I've received approximately a 26% pay increase and a net take-home pay of about $400 every week. Every bi-weekly check that I've received from the federal government. So that is a substantial pay increase for the average frontline worker. The average frontline worker received about 20 to 30% pay increases across the board. Depends upon your time in service. So they're very excited. And also you have what they call a transition to where you can actually see what you're going to make 10 years from now. So for me right now, I'm GS-9 step 4 equivalent. So over the next 15 years, I'll progress myself up to a GS-9 step 10 equivalent. So I'll be able to see what my pay is going to be, what my when we get a cost of living increase, it's going to stay for me the rest of my career. Whereas in the past, it may not have always been that way. So you have a lot more transparency in the future.
No, that's good. And what it'll also do is maybe the turnover rate won't be so high. Because look, I don't know how you guys do the job you do, the abuse that you have to take, especially, you know, post-COVID. Now that we're in this new, I just had a conversation with a friend who works at ATU, the Amalgamated Transit Union, the number of their bus drivers who are getting beat up every day. I was talking to somebody at NALC, the Postal Workers Union, the number of postal workers who are getting beat up every day, the violence, the obnoxious behavior of people. I don't know how you do it because, flying is tense enough, being in that environment tense enough, and then having to deal with people. Don't know how you do it. You're worth every penny.
I want to say the best way that I handled that as my experience over 20 years, a lot of times I always felt like I was working in a circus and you never know exactly what show you were going to get that day. But now with the passengers being hostile, I hate to say it. I have friends that are flight attendants and they have told me, and the administrators told us on the council, he said he used to get one or two assaults on TSOs maybe every month. But right now, after the pandemic, he's getting 8 to 10 a week. These are a physical assaults on officers. And now they're starting to really take these guys down and put them in jail. You know, they're fining them hard. They have to curb this behavior. Interfering with the flight is a felony. Assault on a federal officer, that's a felony. These things are being taken seriously. So for those out there thinking you can just play around, don't do it. Follow the instructions. We're only there to do our jobs.
Yeah.
We want you to get your destination safely.
But on the bigger part, Johnny, on the bigger part of all of this, stop being such a-holes. I mean, there's no reason to beat up a bus driver or the postman or any of this stuff. I mean, the level of our inability to talk to each other and to associate just seems to be just getting crazy out of hand. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Johnny Jones. Johnny is the Secretary Treasurer of AFGE Council 100, AFGEcouncil100.org, the website. Now, I got to ask you, because this is great news, and I love good news. I love when my union brothers and sisters get what they're worth and what they earn. But I'm also reading that this could be, short-lived. The Republicans' fiscal 2024, the Homeland Security Appropriations Package, seems like it might gut that.
They're attempting to gut some of the pay increases. Our indication is that the frontline workforce may not be impacted, but other components may be impacted, more specifically the air marshals, canine handlers, other people that work behind the scenes as support staff. But it is a concerning situation because what happens if they decide not to fund us next year? It could be the TSOs next year. So we all need to understand to stand together to make sure that our pay equity is permanent. And when you have people playing political games with your security in the air, you don't want that. The average TSO on the floor is about under 4 years of experience. You go back 7 or 10 years ago, the average officer had about 7 years experience. That's because of the massive turnover. You don't want that. We have to stop that. And Congress needs to stop playing with people's lives. because the way you're going to deal with that is you're going to keep bringing in new people. It's going to know they don't have the same experience as me. I'm a 20-year veteran. I can see something that it takes another person 15 years to learn. So you can't replace experience.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. But the sad reality is you guys are, you know, they say, you know what rolls downhill. Sometimes government workers are at the bottom of that hill, and potentially yep. another shutdown come September where you guys, I don't know how you do it, but again, I'm glad you do.
Yeah, we have there's always the threats of government shutdown. They're also trying to roll back any of your rights that you receive. Like right now we have paid parental leave. Paid parental leave is under attack. Your federal health insurance is under attack. Your pension is under attack. Everything is under attack. People think we're government fat cats. We made the least amount of money of any federal employee in the federal government. We are frontline national security officers, and here we are getting treated really badly by Congress, and hopefully we don't have that problem anymore. We have been getting support on both sides of the aisle, but that has to stop.
Yeah. But I got to tell you, Johnny, good on you. I appreciate the work that you do, keeping the country safe and doing it with a smile. Every person I've ever dealt with the TSA when I fly has always been professional and decent to me, even though if I may have been myself a little miffed of having to take my shoes off. But good on you and good on your members. Congratulations. You guys earned this. And I wish you the best.
I want to say thank you, and I'm happy to come on the show anytime. I appreciate your hospitality and listening to our issue on Mr. Rick Smith's show.
I appreciate it, Johnny. Thanks so much. Good stuff. Johnny Jones, he is the Secretary Treasurer there at AFGE Local 100, AFGE Council 100.org. I'll get it right. Trust me. It's been a long day. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Tell me what you think. Can we be more civil? Is it possible? Quick break, right back. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1869. That was the day labor leader William Silvis died. Silvis was born in Armbaugh, Pennsylvania. He learned the trade of wagon making from his father, but soon he left home to take up an apprenticeship as an iron worker. He found work in Philadelphia. At the time, there was an increasing practice of iron molders to hire unskilled workers as helpers for the skilled craftsmen. This led to skilled workers seeing their wages cut. Silvis joined a strike against the wage erosion led by the Journeyman Stove and Hollowware Molders Union. Soon, he was elected secretary of the union, but Silvis understood that to truly have power, the iron molders would need to organize beyond Philadelphia. And so, in 1859, 12 molders from various unions met in Philadelphia to plan to join together. The Civil War put those plans on hold. During the war, as men went to fight, many workers saw their wages increase due to the labor shortage. But prices at the stores rose even more quickly, and it became harder and harder to make ends meet. Recognizing the need for labor to organize, in 1863, Silvis helped found the Iron Molders International Union. He became the first president of the new union. 21 locals joined under the Iron Molders International Union, and it grew to include 8,000 workers. But Silvis had a bigger vision for the labor movement. He thought all skilled trades should band together to improve wages and working conditions. So in 1866, he founded the National Labor Union. The National Labor Union quickly grew to 30,000 workers. But Silvis died in 1869, cutting short his efforts to grow a national union. The union continued until 1873, when it dissolved.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
So the war on libraries continues because, hey, those libraries, they may have drag shows. I can't say that with a straight face. That's the fear. They're gonna have drag shows, I guess. I'm looking at this story from Houston. Yeah, Texas is fighting to be the new Florida. Politically, they're losing their freaking minds. But evidently, the Houston Independent School District, evidently, they're getting rid of librarians. 28 schools will no longer have librarians. They're gonna change libraries into team centers. Yeah, these are going to be team centers where Kids with behavioral issues, that's where they're going to go. We used to call that detention. Yeah, we had a detention hall where that's where you went. We're going to turn libraries into that. And this is, I guess, part of this new superintendent's new education system, which I guess is destroy libraries and use them as prisons. I'm guessing that's what this is. Now, there are a total of 85 schools that have joined into this program, and 28 of them will lose their libraries. I'm going to lose their librarians, and I guess they can transition into other roles, prison guard, warden, whatever. The remaining 57 school librarians will be assessed on a case-by-case basis. We'll decide down the road whether your school is worthy of having a library. I'm not making this up. This isn't a joke. I mean, because I got to be honest, when I was reading this, I'm going, what? You're doing away with the librarians? And then you're going to take all of the people with behavior problems and you're going to shove them into the library? Where are the people who want to read going to go? Oh, that's right. Don't care. Because we don't want them to read. Now, they claim there are some folks who are against this saying, hey, this team center idea, maybe not such a great idea for the kids who actually want to learn. Maybe not such a great idea. But this is where they're going. Now, I fully now expect this kind of thing to spread across the country because bad ideas tend to do this. They tend to spread. I got to wonder, though, if they will leave the books in the room that is now the new detention center, and if the argument will be, well, we can't leave the books because they'll then be weapons because they might read them and get an idea. Wow. Scary and crazy all at the same time. But it's Texas. And what would you expect? But scary and crazy all at the same time. And I point to the fact that Greg Abbott, the governor there, just signed a piece of legislation recently that would make owners of electric vehicles have to pay an annual fee of $200. They're going to be taxed an annual fee. Or they're calling it a toll. It's not a tax. It's a toll. It's a yearly toll. And a one-time fee of $400 to register their cars. Because in Texas, we don't want no EVs. We want gas guzzlers. It kind of reminds me of what a lot of Republicans did year, like 2013, if I remember right, we're around there, where people were putting solar panels on their house, and then the idea of taxing people with solar panels became their bright idea. Hey, we'll punish those people who aren't using electricity and are creating their own, and in some months, like we do, actually some goes back to the grid. We're going to punish them by taxing them on what they create. That sounds like a great idea. Would incentivize people to want to do it. Now, what's interesting is the rest of the country seems to be moving in that direction. The big automakers have come together, seven of them, General Motors, BMW, Honda, Hyundai, Kia, Mercedes-Benz, and Stellantis. They've come together and said, hey, we're going to start building infrastructure. We know EVs are the wave of the future. We're going to start building them like crazy. People need to be able to charge them. It's clear that the oil companies are not going to do it. It's clear that, the big fuel station chains probably aren't going to do it. So they're going to build at least 30,000 chargers in the U.S. and in Canada, which will help move in that direction. Because a lot of people are going, well, how can I get from place A to place B, with only one charge? Fair enough. Now, I personally have a lot of problems with moving to all electric vehicles for the environment aside, all in favor of, saving the planet, all of that. Not fond of the electric vehicle idea that everything is recorded, everything's in real time, trackable. I'm a privacy guy. I'm a little weirded out by that. But this is a way of, doing something to help with the environment. Now understand, people are thinking about buying them. The numbers are going up. And as you make it easier, as you have infrastructure that's there, because look, I know people who have them, they love them. I know people who, as much as I don't like Elon Musk, the Tesla, from what I'm told, is fabulous. It really is a decent car. And you know, one of those things where if you can help save the planet and get decent mileage and not have to pay, you know, through the nose for fuel and get off of the dirty stuff, it seems like a win-win. Now, here's the problem. China is going full tilt boogie. Evidently, according to reports over at Axios, the Chinese EVs are coming and they're flooding the market in Europe. Might not be too long before they try and bring them here. Considering the average price of an EV in this country is about $55,000, the Chinese one's much, much cheaper. And you go, would you buy a Chinese? No, I don't know. Again, I go back to that. I'm a privacy guy. No. The answer, no. But this again is, for me, is kind of an exciting time because there's going to be a transition. The market is deciding this. Now, the president has spent some money in moving us in that direction and nudging in that direction, but we were heading this way. The market is deciding, and it's interesting to watch the right lose their minds because they want their gas guzzlers because they're deeply entrenched in the pockets of the oil industry. Now, understand, we're not going to get rid of oil. Still going to need it. Still going to use it. There's tons of things that it's good for, just like coal. I mean, yeah, I knew a guy who was a professor at West Virginia University, and he said, you know, in 50 years, we're going to look back and go, can't believe we burned this stuff because there are so many things you could do with it that this guy was, you know, explaining that, you know, burning it seemed to be a waste. For me, it just seems that we can do better. Now, here's the thing. This is where my mind goes immediately. If we're going to the electric cars, if we're going to the EVs, if we're going to build charging stations, this is where the idea that Jerry Brown had back in 92 is the right one. We do need to rewire the country. We do need to have a better grid system. You know, I was told recently that, you know, we lose an enormous amount of power, energy through transmission lines. We have the technology to do better. This could be a national call to action, and the jobs that would come, and, you know, all the benefits that would come from doing it, which is probably why we won't be doing it. But we should be. We should be, you know, remaking our grid system, you know, not just to get us the things that we need, but also, you know, thinking about national security. Because guess what? AI and cyber warfare, that's the future. And, you know, if you can shut down the power grid, especially if everything's electric. And again, I have this problem with being hyper dependent on one thing. You know, living in a more rural community, you now need, you know, I see the need to be, you know, somewhat independent, somewhat able to heat your home with other alternative fuels, wood and pellets and stuff that people do. The need for, you know, I know right now the right is losing their mind over hot water heaters. And while I think electric hot water heaters are good and they're efficient and all of that, I know people in cold areas that say, look, you got to have the gas because it heats it up. It's much better at heating the hot water in cold temperatures. You can't have a one size fits all. And that's my problem with a lot of this. We're going to a one system where our grid can't handle what we're doing now. What happens when we do transition over to the new stuff? What happens when all of our things are electric and we're still dealing? We've got 21st century transportation and 21st century, you know, appliances on a 20th century grid. How is that going to work? And I know there's movement in getting us there. It's just not happening fast enough. Because look, the market is moving quickly. The market is moving us towards, whether you like it or not, the market is moving us towards electric vehicles. The market is moving us. These automakers are staking their future on it. And in a big way. The fact that they're the ones who are going, look, we're going to put these charging stations in. Now, understand, they're going to profit from it. This is a way for them to get in there and profit from it. Just like, you know, look, they're going to take every advantage possible. This is where legislation, this is where politics comes into place. For instance, this is where I want to finish. Ford recently, not too long ago, and I talked about this a couple months ago, They want to be able to repossess your car from anywhere, remotely. So, you know, you don't pay your bill. All of a sudden, your car just disappears. Your car is gone. It's just driving down the road without you. Because it's been repossessed.